We're talking asphalt, concrete, and a grand vision for the Metro Parks on This Week in the CLE today. It's the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn here with my colleagues Laura Johnston, Jane Cahoon, and Layla Atassi. It's Thursday. It certainly feels like it should be Friday or even Saturday, but we're here for a discussion. Let's go. How does the announcement that there will be a possible concrete and asphalt plant on Opportunity Corridor fit in with the original vision announced for that very expensive road? Layla Tassi, Eric Isaac posted a story this morning that's eye-opening. I mean, I kind of can't believe that we're headed down this path, and I don't quite understand how it was kept secret for so long. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, this doesn't make a ton of sense. So this is about the Workforce Development-focused Construction Opportunity Institute of Cleveland and the plans to put their headquarters on Opportunity Corridor. Among other things, the nonprofit that's handling this project wants to build asphalt and concrete plants, as you said, on the site, which has really upset some of the organizations that have been working with the city on all the economic development plans around Opportunity Corridor. They're also upset by how secretive Frank Jackson's administration has been about these plans. The two agencies that are raising the concerns about this are Burton Belcar Development Incorporated, which is a Kinsman-based development corporation, and the Fund for Our Economic Future, which is a Northeast Ohio nonprofit focused on economic growth. Both were really heavily involved in acquiring dozens of acres of land along this 3.6-mile boulevard that would link I-77 and 490 at East 55th Street to University Circle. After obtaining all that land, they handed it over to the Cleveland Land Bank, and sources told Cleveland.com that the city promised to keep these two groups in the loop as the plans took shape. But so far, they don't seem to have done that. Not when they decided to put the new police headquarters along the route, and not as it relates to this latest project involving the asphalt and concrete plants. They found out about those things through an article in Cranes recently. So these groups have reservations about whether that site is the best place for that kind of operation. They rightly, in my opinion, are worried about how it might affect the surrounding neighborhood and the residents and other businesses and opportunities for future growth along this very important stretch of road that's being developed. Not surprisingly, Cleveland City Council members don't seem to know how they feel about it. They were supposed to have a hearing about the issue, but it was canceled. And Councilwoman Phyllis Cleveland, who represents that ward, said that she largely supports the project and would like to see it succeed. But she said she needs to learn more about how it would impact the neighborhood. So a lot of wishy-washiness from council. As you said, it's very unclear why they would be doing something like this to such an important area.
Right, so a few things here before I rip into this is, you know, when we found out the police station was going out there, we raised all sorts of questions about it. It took a while for Jackson to explain it, but he finally did come over and in about 3 minutes or 4 minutes laid out the case for it that all made sense. It's a piece of land that wouldn't have been useful for other things. It was going to bring safety. And everybody was like, okay, that makes sense. You should have said that on the front end. So, maybe when he speaks up about this, he'll be able to provide reasons why this makes sense. But on the surface, this makes no sense. I mean, if you've ever seen a concrete or an asphalt plant, they put those things in the middle of nowhere for a reason. If you ever drive out west on the turnpike, there's a big one out there in the middle of nowhere because there's lots of particulate with asphalt. It stinks. I mean, if Opportunity Corridor was designed to attract light industry and offices, who in their right mind would put those things next to an asphalt plant or even within a mile of it? Plus, there's houses out there. Why should the residents have to deal with that? This one boggles my mind. And what it reminds me of, Jane Cahoon, you'll remember this, but Layla and Laura will have no memory. 25 years ago, after the big plans for the Chagrin Highlands were put together, this was the part of Eastern Cuyahoga County. The city owned the land. It was in a bunch of other suburbs, and they had an agreement to develop this as a center of office parks, kind of like what they have in North Carolina. And 25 years ago, Mayor Michael R. White decided we're going to allow big box there, and it turned it into just one big shopping mecca, which will all be abandoned someday So the grand vision fell to pieces and turned into what you see. Is that happening with Opportunity Corridor?
I certainly hope not. I mean, Cleveland has been waiting for this for so long, and so much money has been invested. And really, this was a part of the city that Frank Jackson has long said has been forgotten and needs this sort of revitalization. And everyone is behind it to kind of throw away the opportunity with something that would be both an eyesore and also deeply impact air quality in the surrounding neighborhood would be such a disappointment.
Maybe his secret plan is to wreck the vision for Opportunity Corridor so he can put a dirt bike trail. Because if you have an asphalt plant,
that's a deep cut.
A dirt bike trail. This one boggles the mind. Nice job by Eric Isaac. The story is published today, raising some serious questions. We'll wait and see what the answers are. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What's the grand new vision that the Metro Parks have for part of the Cleveland Lakefront? And is it as doable as it seems? Laura Johnston, we've seen all sorts of dreamy visions for lakefront development that all seem questionable. We always talk about when are they going to close Burke Lakefront Airport and really do something there. And then the Metro Parks comes out with this plan that Steve Litt reported yesterday. And it seems like this is something we can do. And it's visionary.
Yeah, this is so cool. And I have to say, I haven't been paying that close of attention in the last year. But I feel like this came out of nowhere, that people really haven't been talking about it forever and ever and ever. They want to add 80 acres of parkland to the east side shoreline. This is where I-90 gets really close to Lake Erie, where on windy days, the waves just wash up onto the shoreway. They want 36 acres of those to be an island with a bridge and trail so you can go over there. So we are talking long-term planning here. This is 20 years in the future. It's not going to happen immediately. But the city supports the idea. So does ODOT. And it would really tame the lake as well as create this incredibly nice park where there's currently basically a strip of a path along the highway. There's even historical precedent. The city of Cleveland's 2004 waterfront district plan envisioned creating a series of islands east and west of downtown for dredge sediment. But this solves a lot of problems. It would bring the sediment from the river. They have to dredge it all the time to make sure the barges can get down there to the steel plant. It would protect the shoreline, give recreation opportunities for an area that doesn't have a lot. And they're hoping they could maybe get some of Joe Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure money to make it happen.
Yeah, and finding a place to put the dredge, all that sludge they dredge up from the bottom of the river, the Cuyahoga River, to keep it navigable, that's been a problem. They haven't had a place to put it. This is a good use of it. There's precedent for it. Dyke 14, which is kind of a bird sanctuary now, was built that way. So this is cool. I mean, yeah, and the completion of it would be 20, 25 years away, but this is something that they could start working on now. And I imagine that they could phase it so that parts of it would be usable well before then. They actually are comparing it to Edgewater Park,
right?
Just one for the east side, which wouldn't that be great?
Right. But the east side's not like, we don't want Edgewater Light. We want our own thing, right? And there have been talks in the past. The Green Ribbon Coalition wanted to move I-90, you know, where the First Energy plant is over there, Cleveland Power Plant too, and move it so that they have more land and there's a park on the south side and a park on the north side to make sure that they make sense. This doesn't include moving the highway, which, you know, that would be a massive undertaking, but it does have better bridges and connections to the existing park on the south side. And yeah, it seems like, you know, you're like, wow, this makes a lot of sense. Why didn't we come up with it before? And Steve Litt has a great story. It's on cleveland.com, and really cool renderings of what it could look like with this cove that would make that part of Lake Erie really navigable for, you know, paddle boards and kayaks. And it could be really cool.
Of course, you could have an enormous lakefront park really easily. Close Burke Lakefront Airport. Close Burke Lakefront
Maybe
Airport.
Maybe they can put an asphalt plant there.
You know, we have successfully made the closing of Burke Lakefront Airport a question in the mayor's race. Every candidate that comes out, we ask. Justin Bibb, it was immediate, shut it down. Kevin Kelly, not so much. That could be a deciding factor in this race. People want that lakefront restored to public use, not wasted for a few landings and takeoffs each day.
I do have to give credit to the Metro Parks, which has managed all of those lakefront parks since 2013. I can't believe it's been, you know, almost a decade now. They've really transformed it. And I think people really appreciate that access to the lake.
You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and some legislators have all sorts of police reforms they suddenly want to institute in a week when the nation is thinking about police abuse, particularly abuse of people who are not white. Jane Cahoon, it's a long list. Let's go through them.
So a lot of what DeWine talked about on Wednesday wasn't really new, but it took on renewed importance because, as you said, you know, he was speaking the day after Derek Chauvin's conviction for the murder of George Floyd and this horrible Columbus police shooting of a teenage girl that occurred around the same time of the verdict. But just a little quick history, DeWine had proposed a number of these reforms last June after Floyd's murder, which sparked, as we know, all kinds of civil rights protests in Ohio and around the nation. And after he did that in June, a couple of Republican lawmakers proposed legislation as sort of an alternative to what DeWine was proposing. And that didn't go anywhere in the last session. So here we are now, 10 months later, and we have another announcement of this new legislation by these same two Republican lawmakers. That's State Reps Phil Plummer, who's a former Montgomery County Sheriff, and Cindy Abrams, an ex-Cincinnati police officer. So that's what DeWine was talking about Wednesday, and it appears to be a blend of some of the reforms he was proposing and some of the stuff that was in this former bill. So what are they proposing? A police licensing board, increased training for officers, requiring independent investigations of police shootings, and setting up a use of force and disciplinary action databases. And in addition, the budget that's now being considered by the legislature as it's currently written would provide $10 million for law enforcement agencies to buy body cameras for officers, as well as $1 million for local agencies to recruit more women and minorities into law enforcement. And it also provides $15 million to help offset the cost of yearly training requirements that are already set by the state. So DeWine also talked about some additional reforms his administration is undertaking, like some of the ones he announced in June, including requiring all Ohio Highway Patrol troopers to wear body cameras, banning state-level law enforcement officers from using chokeholds on people, except in life or death situations, and setting some new standards for how police should respond to mass protests. So do these sound like good things? Yes, they do. But the rub is that no members of the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus or any House Democrats, for that matter, have really been consulted on this legislation. Now, they did, Plummer and Abrams did hold hearings around the state that I think anybody was welcome to attend. But, you know, they didn't really seek buy-in from the lawmakers who represent these constituencies who would be so affected by all of this and are so affected by the problems that we have with policing. But, you know, that's kind of the way they legislate in Columbus. So
there are two things about this that are worth thinking about. One is smaller, but, you know, Cleveland police have negotiated in their union contract that their discipline gets removed from their personnel files after a relatively short period of time. It's 3 years or 5 years or something. So if you put together a statewide database of that while it's still in their files, it'll be interesting to see if they argued, well, that should come out of the database after that period of time. It's a ridiculous clause in the contract to remove that so that people cannot find that in a very short period of time because you've had a lot
of... Well, the governor didn't have an answer to the question as to whether those databases would be public record. He was asked that. So anyway,
go ahead. How they wouldn't be public record. There's no reason. There is absolutely no justification.
He said he was, he'd get back to reporters.
Yeah, well, that we would have something to say about that. The bigger thing is that in this week where we had the verdict and the whole nation was on edge wondering what would happen, we've had a series of police shootings. I mean, police continue to shoot Black people with abandon in very questionable situations. And you start to wonder, is this kind of reform working within the institutions that exist the right way to go? Or should we just remake the way we police in this country somehow? Because what we've done is populated our police departments in part with white supremacists that are willing, wantonly, are shooting Black people. I mean, it's just happening over and over and over again. I have a reader, a far right wing reader who sends me all sorts of stuff all the time. He gets from Fox News. And he tried to bait me recently by sending me a question. Why don't you report about when police shoot white people? But the answer is, when it comes to per capita, that there's no comparison in the number of people that are getting shot. Yeah. So I just, you know, okay, you create a licensing thing, you do training. If you're not doing things to make sure you don't have white supremacists on the force, what is that? What's going to happen? We had the DEA shooting last week in Cleveland. Guy comes home, sees a couple of people sitting in front of his house, looking suspicious. He has a gun. He walks up to the car. He lifts his shirt to show them he has a gun. I'm presuming he's stopping to ask them, what are you doing here? And the agent gets out of the car and shoots him. And then they put out statements that he brandished a gun. He didn't aim a gun at the DEA agent. You can't shoot somebody who's not aiming a gun at you. If you look at the Columbus police, what they said after they shot a teenage girl, they called her a young woman. They didn't call her a teenage girl. They didn't say she was a kid. Said it was a young woman. And then look at the way it's reported. It's not the police shot and killed somebody. It's called police involved shootings to kind of make it sound somehow antiseptic. It's just the system seems completely broken. And do these reforms fix that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, are you looking to this legislature to fix this problem, Chris? Stephanie House, who's a former president of the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, she's from Cleveland. She said, it's hard for me to believe that whatever they put out will be in a spirit of leading to healing and building confidence, specifically from Black and Brown communities, when you have not been intentional in having those voices in that piece of legislation.
Well, I hope the movement that's been started here does not go into remission because of the conviction. I hope it's the first step, because it's just a frightening problem to have the people you vest with the power to remove liberty having this record of just killing people left and right. And this week, the Columbus police shot and killed that girl within moments of the verdict being announced. And already the mayor, the police chief, it's justifiable. They protected life without doing the full investigation. It's very questionable how these things are being investigated. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Has Ohio neared its ceiling on how many residents will get the coronavirus vaccines? Is there any other way to read the decision in Summit County to cut back on vaccination clinics? Well, Atassi, it's kind of a scary moment if we're reaching the top limit of how many people will get the vaccines, because if that's true, the coronavirus will continue to spread and mutate, endangering everybody.
I agree. So they opened this clinic at the Summit County Fairgrounds back in early April, and they were supposed to run it for 3 or 4 days a week until May 28th. But they're scaling it back to once per week starting April 27th. And they say it's because of decreased demand, just as you noted. Also, Summit County Public Health wants to focus on vaccinating schools and businesses and churches to try to reach those holdouts who haven't gotten the shot yet, and to try to kind of bring the vaccine right to them. This was one of 15 state-sponsored max vaccination sites in Ohio. You know, interestingly, though, I was thinking about, you know, Cuyahoga County Board of Health also is scaling back its clinics. On their website, I noticed it says they're no longer pre-registering people for the shot and that they're currently running clinics just to work through the existing waiting list. And they attribute that decision to the combination of the state making vaccine available to all the adults and an increase in supply and the presence of the Wolstein Center event to meet the demand. So this seems to be kind of par for the course among these mass vaccination events. They expected more people to be interested in inoculation than seemed to be the case. It's kind of depressing. It is to think that we've reached the limit.
And what they're suggesting now is that their strategy, because they've gotten the big groups, their strategy needs to be they got to get out to where the people are and try and target smaller groups. There are people that may not have had the transportation or what have you. And so they're going to try and reach them in their neighborhoods. Laura Johnston and I were talking yesterday about people who've just been too lazy to go get the shot, that they didn't want to fight and spend time on the internet trying to find an appointment, and they just haven't gotten around to it. I don't know what you do to motivate them, but it's kind of, I mean, it sounds like we may get to maybe 60% and that'll be it, which is interesting because Mike DeWine might switch his metric to vaccination rate in the state if he sets that too high, we may never get there.
Right, right. You know, I also wonder what else can be done to work through some of the issues among, you know, the minority communities who might have reluctance based on historic problems with the healthcare system. And you know, Chris, I sent you that note yesterday about how I saw that the Word Church has been having a lot of vaccine clinics and has really been pushing it out to their congregation. And I wonder what they're seeing on the ground in terms of reluctance in their community and how they're going about, you know, their grassroots effort to break that down and make sure that as many people have access and choose it as possible.
This is Laura Johnston. I just think it is so crazy that 2 months ago we were having lotteries to see if you could get an appointment at the Summit County Board of Health. And, you know, the vaccine queens were working night and day to try to get appointments. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, the tap turned off, like there's plenty of vaccine and we can't find people to give it to. And, you know, I know people that are like, yeah, I'm going to get it. I just didn't want to like fight about it. And I, you know, I'll get around to it. But yeah, I don't know how many of those people there are. And I hate to think that we're done. Like, I just, obviously, there's going to be a whole lot of kids eventually that will be able to get vaccinated. But yeah, this, I'm with Layla. This is disheartening.
You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Is the move to require political affiliations for Supreme Court races on the general election ballots a Republican ploy to stop losing seats to Democrats on the Ohio Supreme Court? Jane Cahoon, I have a feeling you have strong thoughts about this.
Am I allowed to express my personal opinion?
You sure can.
I think this is a nakedly political move, but you can judge for yourself. So the argument here, and it's a good one, for this legislation is about transparency, that voters should have all the information about the candidates they're voting on, including their political affiliation, which now, you know, obviously appears on the primary ballot in a partisan primary, but not for the general election for judicial candidates. And the argument against it by people like Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, who happens to be a Republican, and professional organizations representing lawyers, they say it's going to just increase the perception that the court system is politicized. In any event, this bill that the Senate passed on Wednesday along party lines, it's called Senate Bill 80, would require the affiliations to be listed on the general election ballot, but only for the Supreme Court, the Ohio Supreme Court, and the Court of Appeals, not at the county or the municipal level. So that part is a change from a bill that was previously proposed in the last session, but didn't make it all the way to passage. This current bill also would move the Supreme Court races to near the top of the ballot with the other statewide candidates. Apparently, there's a big drop off in the number of people who vote, you know, for the courts by the time they get there on the ballot. Now, what might be the political motivation here? While Democrats have not had any luck electing their candidates to statewide executive offices in recent years, they've managed to get like three justices elected to the Ohio Supreme Court in the last couple of elections. And they've cut into the Republican majority on the court, which is now just 4-3. And in 2022, we have a very consequential Supreme Court election with the Chief Justice's seat opening and two Republican justices up for re-election. So the stakes are really high. Now, in fairness, I should point out that for the appeals court, Republicans have won a lot of those seats in Democratic areas. So they might be disadvantaging themselves a bit with this legislation. But I think their eyes are on the prize of the Supreme Court. And, you know, if this is such a good idea, why are they not doing it across the board? Right?
You're right. This is just a naked grab for power. Ohio does have the most screwed up system in existence. You have a partisan primary for all the judges, but then in the general, you don't see the party affiliation, which is just stupid. And, you know, you should go one way or the other. It should be nonpartisan. The Chief Justice, Maureen O'Connor, argues that judges don't make decisions based on politics or philosophy. They base them on court precedent. So the parties should not be a part of the decision-making process. So if you want to go that way, get rid of it in the primary and get rid of all the dark money that comes in from conservative and liberal causes, because that pretty much makes it a partisan system. Or give people information. But I think this, you're right, by not doing it for all judges, it's clearly...
I mean, really.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Is Lakewood's removal of basketball hoops from Madison Park yet again, a legitimate move for public safety or a decision aimed at running certain kinds of people out of the park. Leila Tassi, Lakewood has done this before. They've taken basketball hoops out of another park altogether after removing them temporarily. What's the story here?
Yeah, this isn't a good look for Lakewood. It's bad. You know, Madison Park is located in what's known as the Birdtown neighborhood on Lakewood's southeast side, and it's the most racially diverse neighborhood in the city. Recently, the city has seen a couple shootings at that park near the basketball courts, and suspects have been arrested and charged. So the city's response was to close down the courts and remove the hoops. And as you said, Chris, this was the same kind of decision they made back in 2014 at Kauffman Park when residents were complaining about unsupervised kids using bad language while playing basketball late into the night. This week's decision to remove the hoops wasn't explained to residents at all. Mayor Megan George simply said that new evidence has come to light in the investigations of these shootings that necessitates the removal of these hoops. Well, you know, that really wasn't good enough for residents. A group of about 12 activists went to Madison Park with a portable basketball hoop this week and played ball in protest of what they see as basically an act of profiling. And clearly, you know, the city is making assumptions about the kinds of people who come to play basketball at that park, because they're certainly not closing down tennis courts, right? You know, so, but what I find really interesting about this, about the protest, is that a police officer sat in an SUV nearby while this group played, and the cop didn't get out to remind the protesters that, in fact, the courts are closed. And it makes one wonder if that was because, well, the protesters were a group of middle-aged white women. What if a group of Black teens from the neighborhood showed up to protest instead and brought their own hoop? What would that officer have done in that case? I think the answer is pretty clear. And, you know, I mean, the city can't really argue that the basketball court closure isn't meant to discriminate against a particular group of people when clearly the closure of the court doesn't apply to white women at all. So...
yeah, this is the simple kind of stupid move to deal with the problem. Instead of dealing with the problem head on in a thoughtful way, trying to make the park safe, it's a knee-jerk move. And I'm surprised that Lakewood residents are standing for it, because it's a fairly liberal city that you just wouldn't think this is the way they'd behave. And it's a new administration that's doing it this time. And the idea that new evidence came up, it's like, what's the new evidence that you discovered that the people playing basketball are Black?
Right.
You
know,
come on. This is no way to go about dealing with a problem. And you would expect more from a city as enlightened as Lakewood.
Right.
You're listening to This Week in the CLE. All right, Leila, we're going to get to this question after all. So get excited, okay. Even though it's Laura's. Why does Ohio Governor Mike DeWine think littering in Ohio is such a big problem that he needs a campaign to reduce it? Laura Johnston, I'm coming to you. This is something that I hear about from a public official who I won't name pretty regularly, who goes off all the time about the litter all over the interstates running through Cleveland. What's going on?
Well, it is disheartening to look out the window when you're driving and just see trash everywhere. And, you know, especially when you're on I-90 on the west side, it's kind of like a tunnel. So it just feels like everything's stuck down there. But littering costs the state $4 million every year. ODOT workers pick it up. It's stuff at the time that they can't be doing other road issues. And in last year, they picked up over 362,000 bags of trash along the roadway. So I will throw it to Leila now.
All right. Here's
Leila Tassi, go.
This is what I have to say about this, okay? Okay. You know, trash blows around and it has to get picked up, and that's a problem, and it's a bummer. But I have never known anyone who is objectively pro-litter, and I refuse to believe that littering should be the environmental issue DeWine is choosing to highlight on Earth Day. You know, I recently read articles about how the anti-littering campaign was actually designed by the manufacturing industries to try to divert public attention away from the fact that they are actually producing just way too much junk. And this started after World War II, when manufacturing was in full tilt. And to keep people consuming stuff, manufacturers started designing many products with limited lifespans. Essentially, they were made to break, so you'd have to replace it. And they also started churning out these non-renewable packaging. Packaging is a third of all the trash in the U.S. Well, this caused a lot of pollution, and some state legislatures started passing laws banning these sorts of packaging and products. So leaders in the packaging industry teamed up with like Coca-Cola and Dixie Cups and stuff to form Keep America Beautiful, which launched a campaign to highlight how litter was a scourge on the environment. So focusing on the responsibilities of the individual, not manufacturers, and distracting the nation's attention from the real problem. So, you know, Laura, you and I talked about this recently. Along the same vein, it's been widely documented that most recyclables don't end up getting recycled. Even after you've gone through the process of separating them from your trash, they often end up dumped or shipped overseas where they're dumped. If people knew that their recycling efforts were in vain, they'd probably try to use fewer plastics and buy items without all the disposable packaging. But if that happens, the manufacturing industries lose. So they invest mightily in campaigns to maintain consumers' faith in recycling. So this is all a dirty mind game. So I listen, I say all that to say this. Governor DeWine's message about littering is totally dumb. You know, in honor of Earth Day, he should dig a little deeper and focus on the big problems our environment is actually facing, like, oh, I don't know, the parts of HB6 that gut Ohio's energy efficiency programs and renewable energy mandates, or provide statewide subsidies for two dirty coal plants. How about we have an Earth Day discussion about that instead of guilting the public with images of workers picking up trash along a highway?
AMC. All right, you're on fire.
I think I just wrote a column.
This is all a great way of saying it's Earth Day, and
Mike DeWine's also going to plant a tree for his grandson's birthday. There was that too yesterday.
Well, that's nice. That's nice.
Okay, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Layla. Thank you, everybody who listens to this podcast. We'll be back Friday to wrap up a week of news.